in the cause of Gunner Nelson versus Phyllis Neal. Larry Jordan, your petition.
Thank you, Mr. Ford, for proceeding with this hearing, and Mr. Jordan, your petition.
May it please the court. This is an appeal from an order granting a temporary administration for the estate of Ricky Nelson. This suit arises from, or the application for temporary administration arises from, an airplane crash in which Ricky Nelson died on New Year's Eve in 1985. Also killed in the crash was respondent's husband, Bobby Neal. Ms. Neal sued in 1986, sued Ricky Nelson's estate in U.S. District Court for the Eastern District of Texas. 10 days before the statute of limitations would have expired, Ms. Neal attempted to obtain personal jurisdiction over a personal representative of Nelson's estate by applying to the probate court of Bowie County for a temporary administration. 2 days later, Ms. Neal recognized that her application was not verified as required by Section 131A of the Probate Code and filed a second application through her counsel. 22 minutes later, the trial court entered a written order that appointed William G. Lavender temporary administrator for the estate of Ricky Nelson. Ricky Nelson's son, Gunner, the petitioner, contested the order appointing the temporary administration in the probate court, and the contest was overruled. The Texarkana Court of Appeals affirmed, even though Neal failed to plead and prove three essential elements to obtaining a temporary administration. The first is that is pleading and proving that Ricky Nelson died intestate. The second is that Ricky Nelson's estate included an asset whose situs was within Texas. And finally, Ms. Neal failed to adequately plead and prove necessity for administration. First, and the argument that is really the only argument that need be addressed by this court is the intestacy question. Section 131A of the Probate Code clearly incorporates Section 82 of the Probate Code. Section 131A is that section which deals with applications for temporary administration and what they must contain. Section 82 deals with the standard application for temporary administration. In other words, the legislature was simply incorporating by reference all the requirements for a normal application for administration, plus some additional requirements that had to be demonstrated to obtain a temporary administration. The first requirement that's an issue is the question of intestacy. Ms. Neal did not unequivocally allege in either application that Ricky Nelson died intestate. She merely alleged that Ricky Nelson, that she was unaware whether Ricky Nelson had a will or not. In fact, the appendices to the application indicate that Ms. Nelson was aware, however, of probate proceedings in the California courts. Ms. Neal further, her counsel conceded in the trial court that Mr. Nelson died with a will and has conceded before this court that Nelson died with a will. That is not in question. At that point, one must ask oneself what is left to be decided. To avoid the effect of the fact that Ricky Nelson died with a will, Ms. Neal urges that intestacy in this state doesn't simply mean dying without a will, but rather it means dying without a will admitted to probate in this state. We respectfully submit that this view is far too parochial and constitutes a true affront to the principles of comity between the states.
How would a person who wanted to check this before filing such a an application under Section 82. How in the world would they check worldwide to see that there was no administration or no estate anywhere? But how would they satisfy your requirement that they believe and know that the deceased died in testator?
Your Honor, I think that simply that once one is aware of the state of domicile, and that's not an issue in this case. In California, for instance, I believe that Ms. Neal appears to be aware that there are probate proceedings in this case in California. And under California law, sections, I believe, 327 and 328 of the California Probate Code provide for public notice.
How would she have known that? If the administration's out there in California and she's here in Texas.
How would she have known that?
Yeah, you say she knew it.
Well, the record reflects that she knew because on the date she obtained the temporary administration, she sent notices addressed to a person that happened to be Ricky Nelson's executor and addressed letters to counsel for the estate in California.
It was also his son, wasn't it, the administrator in California?
No, sir, it's David Nelson. It's his brother.
Brother?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. And I agree. There is no way that one could know worldwide.
That's what concerns me. If we make this an absolute requirement that the averment of intestacy be in that application, sometimes, and you have to swear to it.
Well, Your Honor, I don't.
Sometimes you can put an applicant in a pretty difficult position.
I don't think that, and I'm not attempting to put an applicant in that position. I think that all that the law can reasonably demand is that a person exercise due diligence in making inquiry. If after a duly diligent inquiry, one can find no indication that the decedent in question has a will, I believe that one would be perfectly within the law to swear in good faith that there is no will.
Would that be a fact issue?
Would
that be a fact issue?
As to whether or not there...
Yeah, made reasonable efforts or should have known or did know?
No, sir.
Not a fact issue?
No, sir. I don't believe so because we're in the context in which this is being discussed, as I understand it, is your question was addressed to the question of, well, counsel, how could she ever sign an affidavit? And I'm saying that I believe that one could reasonably sign an affidavit. I don't think any court would impose upon us the knowledge of God. And I don't think that could ever be required, or none of us could ever sign affidavits. And well, so, therefore, I don't believe it's a fact issue. I think it's a determination that the affiant has to make in her own mind.
I guess I'm quibbling with you in a sense because I'm trying to get out of you a reconciliation of two concepts.
Yes, sir.
One is that the application must have the name and testacy of the decedent and the fact, time, and place of death. That's one thing it's got to have. It also must be sworn to.
Yes, sir.
You're saying it's not permissible, and this is a question, not a rhetorical question. Mm-hmm. You're saying it's not permissible for an applicant to say, to swear to something on knowledge and belief, or to say that his best information is, or he's not sure of?
Yes, sir.
He can't do that.
That's exactly what I'm saying, because it's my understanding that unless you unequivocally swear in an affidavit, an affidavit that I believe something to be true has been rejected on many occasions.
But is it your suggestion that if they make due diligence and then they can't determine one way or another, then that would be sufficient?
I believe at that point, after a diligent inquiry,
right.
If I can only put myself in the position of the affiant. If I felt that I had made a diligent inquiry and could find no evidence that the decedent died with will, I would feel perfectly in good faith to make the unequivocal allegation and affidavit, or make the unequivocal statement that they died without a will.
Well, would it have been sufficient in this affidavit then if they just inserted after due diligence in the affidavit that to the best of their knowledge they've been able to find no indication of will?
No, Your Honor, it would not have been because that's not unequivocal. And a simple allegation that one is not aware of a fact is not an allegation that you are stating that fact exists.
Why is the pleading so critical here? Maybe I'm missing.
Because
don't you have to prove this? And
No, Your Honor, the pleading is absolutely critical because it determines the jurisdiction of the probate court. This court's held on many occasions, reaching back to Stewart versus Poinbook, that if the fact of the person's deceased, the fact of intestacy, and all the other elements set out, well, not maybe not all, but intestacy, the presence of an asset within the state, and the necessity for administration. If those three things are not shown, those are jurisdictional defects.
But shown, you mean?
There has to be a prima facie verified pleading.
There has to be a verified pleading, but you could come in and defeat that. I mean, couldn't you? That's what I'm trying to get at. Couldn't you come in and say, here is Mr. Nelson's will. It's
yes or no,
the probate in California, and then the trial court should dismiss the case, or am I missing?
Yes, sir. I believe that's absolutely correct.
So why is it so critical what the initial pleading said?
Because one need go no further in this case. If the trial court's jurisdiction was never invoked by the application, it's critical, Your Honor, really for two reasons. Number one, the legislature has specified that intestacy, the unqualified allegation of intestacy, it doesn't say that the legislature doesn't authorize you to, the probate court, to entertain jurisdiction of the cause upon the belief that, well, Your Honor, I believe he may be intestate. It says you must verify the fact of death and intestacy. The second reason it's critical, again, because it is jurisdictional. And the rule is well settled. If jurisdiction doesn't appear on the face of a pleading, any act of the trial court thereafter will be void. More than the rights of these parties are involved, it's the right of every citizen of Texas who is a party to the social contract that we call the Constitution.
But your main complaint is the probate court taking jurisdiction initially and not the probate court's failure to respond to your motion to set aside the...
I'm complaining of both, Your Honor. I believe, however, that this court need go no further than just an examination of the application.
Would you get to your second point in the event we don't agree with you on the first point?
Yes, sir. In the event, even if this court determines that the application is sufficient, however, we then go to the proceedings at the hearing on the contents. At the hearing on the contents, the counsel for Nelson presented, albeit in an informal manner, a certified copy of California court records indicating that Ricky Nelson's will had been admitted to probate.
In a trial before the court?
In a hearing.
In a hearing before the court.
Why was it a formal presentation?
Because I believe that, quite candidly, I don't think that either side, almost in this situation as when one presents a motion for new trial after a default judgment, I don't think outside really anticipated or appreciated the fact that there was a burden of proof to be discharged and that one side had that burden and that they needed to discharge it.
Is it true that none of these documents offered at this hearing were admitted into evidence by the court?
The trial court did not say the magic words, they're admitted or not admitted into evidence.
The trial court handled these documents, look at them and read them?
They were before him, Your Honor.
And there's a record of that proceeding?
Yes, sir. There's a statement of facts in this case, so I think
it clearly shows that the trial court was aware of the document, contacted the document, and had a dialogue with counsel about the document.
That is correct,
but they were not in admissible form, and I take it. I mean, not an
that is not correct, Your Honor. They bore the seal of the California court. Albeit a stamp, but it's the same similar form used by the clerk of this court and other courts of appeal across the state that state that this is a true and correct copy of the records of the court.
Is that certification by the California court in our record here?
Yes, sir, it is. Or at least it's in my copy of your transcript. I can't imagine that the Xerox machine will remove things I've never seen it add.
Is it a certification of a docket sheet?
No, sir, it is not. It is a certification upon that actually appears upon the
face of the document.
Well, there is a cover sheet for the documents, and the documents are all part of that.
Can you tell me what were those documents? Just walk us through. What did the trial court have before?
As I understand it, it was the docket was actually one docket that demonstrated that the California court had admitted the will of Ricky Nelson to probate and that appointing David Nelson as executor and swearing David Nelson in, and it recited the terms of the will, as I recall.
That's not part of the record before us. We don't have a copy of that.
Yes, sir, you do.
Is it part of the record?
Yes, sir, it is.
And were all the other records about this proceeding sealed in California?
To the best of my knowledge, they were sealed from the general public. Yes, sir.
This was one of the sealed records from California that was produced in Texarkana.
It was not available, as I understand it. And again, I can only go on what the record reflects. The court refused to divulge whatever records may have been requested.
So Mrs. Neal couldn't have gotten this from California?
Oh, most certainly. All she had to do was proceed to California, not even bring her suit there. All she had to do was proceed to California and file her claim with the probate court there. And once she did that, she could certainly ascertain who was the executor, who would have been the proper person to sue, and there's a number of ways that she could have gotten that person served by existing Texas law.
If in doing what you suggested earlier, exercising due diligence, she had simply made inquiry to California to try to obtain those documents, though they would have been sealed and not available to her.
It's my understanding that the record reflects that if she had simply made a request for documents, that the court would have declined to divulge them because, as the court probably knows, not from the record, but Mr. Nelson was of some note in the entertainment world, and I'm sure that they sealed that for the protection of his family.
If Mr. Nelson died testate and has an executor in the state of California, does the federal court have in personam jurisdiction over him in this case?
I believe not, Your Honor. Not unless... I'm sorry. If the appointment of the temporary administrator is invalid, there is no jurisdiction over a personal representative for Nelson's estate in the underlying lawsuit.
I'm sorry. If the temporary administrator appointment is valid?
It's invalid, Your Honor.
It's invalid.
It's not valid. I beg your pardon.
If Mr. Nelson had not died, the federal court would have jurisdiction over him for having committed a tort in this state, alleged.
Not based upon service upon a third party. But if Mr. Nelson personally had been served,
if he were a resident of California,
certainly,
and he committed a tort in this state,
certainly,
he could be served in the lawsuit in this state.
Yes, sir, under Rule 108 or then in the Civil Practice and Remedies Code provision for that.
But your position is that his executor, who is also a resident of the state of California, cannot be served in that same action?
No, my position is precisely that the executor in California could have been served under the Monarch statutes or under 108.
I'm sorry, I misunderstood. Does the federal district court have in personam jurisdiction over the executor for the Nelson estate who is a resident of California?
To the best of my knowledge, Your Honor, and I'm going to have to confess that I've gone outside the record before this court, to the best of my knowledge, it does not. Not at this time, not over the executor.
All right, well, maybe we've got a semantical problem. Could it get in for something?
He is certainly amenable to process,
all right,
Your Honor.
That was my question.
I'm not trying to be recalcitrant. I just misunderstood
what
you
said. This court doesn't have jurisdiction now, but it could get jurisdiction by his being properly served.
I certainly believe so.
If, to use your terms, Ms. Neal had exercised due diligence with reference to these sealed records out in California, is there anything in the record that tells us whether or not she could have determined whether he died intestate or not?
Well, yes. She could have looked in the newspaper because the California court law requires that to be published in a county paper.
In California?
Yes, sir, in California.
As to whether or not whatever the proceeding was that was sealed in California was with a will or without a will?
No, it requires, as I recall, it requires notice that a will has been admitted to probate. And I believe the notice also requires the identity of the executor to be named for the very purpose of, so that creditors can come in and make their claim.
Well, but the mere fact that some proceedings were going on in California wouldn't indicate whether he had a will or not, would it?
No, it would not. Not necessarily. Which, to me, even leads to, makes it more inexplicable that one would allege that one is unaware. If one wanted a temporary administration and wanted to invoke the jurisdiction of the trial court, had no way of knowing, assuming the facts most favorable to Ms. Neal, had no way of knowing, one would, seems to me, that one could allege in perfectly good faith and with perfect freedom from perjury that no will existed. Now, they may later be proved to be wrong, but that's a matter that could have been entertained at the contest.
Well, what, tell me again how she could have found out there was a will, because she apparently had a letter that said this is sealed records and you can't have it yet.
Well, first of all, she could have simply filed a claim. She knew what court to write to. She could have simply filed a notice of her claim in the California probate proceeding.
Maybe she didn't want to make an appearance in California.
For pending liability out there for some reason?
Mm-hmm.
Well,
laws in Texas are more favorable now than they are in California, which didn't used to be the case.
Well,
it's also a more convenient jurisdiction for the plaintiff.
Well, undoubtedly, it's more convenient, Your Honor,
you don't care about that.
No, of course I do.
You're saying she could have filed out there whether a will had been filed or not. I mean, she could have just filed against the administrator out there. Is that
No, sir. No, Your Honor, I don't. Apparently, I'm not making myself clear. All I'm simply saying is that Ms. Neal, in this case, the court has obviously manifested its concern that somehow that there's going to be a problem, and how in the world are we ever going to find out whether a person has a will or not? My position is, and I think the only position that can be taken that's consistent with the statute and the jurisdictional prerequisites recognized in the Texas law, is that if one's made a reasonably diligent effort, is unable to locate any evidence as to whether or not someone dies, any evidence
I
as to a will.
I general position, but how about in this case? What could she have done?
Ms. Neal could have brought her suit in the Eastern District of Texas just as she did, but apparently she had knowledge of the fact that there was something pending in a California court with regard to her estate. Instead of writing off and saying, I'd like a copy of all your records, she could have simply said, written to the court and said, I would like to file a claim. Would you please provide me with the name of the executor? She also could have written to the attorneys that she wrote a letter to notifying them of the temporary administration on the day it was granted and simply asked, oh, by the way, who's the executor? And we would not have this problem. There are a couple other points. I see that my time is about to expire. And there are a couple other points that I would also like to make. The intestacy, the failure to plead or prove intestacy, is fatal. In fact, the Court of Appeals even recognized that Ms. Neal had the burden to prove intestacy at the contest. It simply determined that in its wisdom, in these facts, intestacy isn't required. We respectfully submit the Court's not at liberty to make that determination. That's within the realm of the legislative body.
Well, we, of course, ascertain the legislative intent, don't we?
Yes, sir, you do.
There are
from
three subsections.
From the plain language of the statute, Your Honor.
Excuse me?
From the plain language of the statute.
That's right. There are other things that the petition must have, must allege, and they're preceded by the term, if known, or if any.
Yes, sir.
And I'm referring to E, F, and G.
Assets of the estate is one of the things that the legislature has specifically provided, that if you know, you can allege those upon belief. That qualification is not present before the intestacy.
If you know where the children, if no.
Yes.
It doesn't seem to me that the legislature is trying to say that A, B, C, and D must absolutely be disclosed in the application, even if you don't know them. But you have the latitude on F, G, E, F, G.
I agree, Your Honor. I see that my time has expired.
The court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Richard Kalsis will present the argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, I'm Dick Countess, and I'm here to present argument on behalf of Phyllis Neal, who, as you know, is the widow of Bobby Neal, one of the band members who was killed when Ricky Nelson's plane crashed. The court, from its questions and from the argument of petitioner's counsel, I think has a clear focus on what's going on here. Within a year after, or in fact exactly a year after the crash, we filed suit in federal court against various defendants, including the Nelson estate. We had a great deal of difficulty getting service on the estate, and finally initiated the proceeding that's now in question before you. Let me, while I'm thinking about it, refer to a couple of things the court asked about in questions. There was some question about the sealing of the file and what kind of information we had and that sort of thing. In the record before you, and I believe it's attached to the application of Bill Bingham, but I'm not absolutely certain of that, but I think that's where you'll find it, is a letter that we received back from the Los Angeles County Clerk and Executive Officer of the Superior Court. And he has written, it's a group of checklists, as you find in clerk's offices, but at the bottom the clerk has written, the documents you seek have been sealed by the court at this time, and there is no final judgment as the case is still pending, and it's signed by the clerk. So they were filed, they were sealed out there, and despite our efforts, we were unable to get them and determine the status of the estate, determine whether a will existed, determine whether who we should serve, all the pertinent information we needed.
And other than asking for the documents.
I'm sorry?
Other than asking for the documents.
Well,
did you ever simply inquire who was the executor and was there a will?
I don't think the record reflects that we did, I have no personal knowledge of that. But I have no reason to believe that they would give us information from a sealed file when the file is sealed. There's nothing in the record to indicate that would work either, to take both sides of it. In the responsive brief, petitioner indicates that I take liberties with the record when I say that they had the file sealed, and let me quickly say that the record does not show who sealed the file. But as an aside, let me say that I have never known a court to seal it on its own motion under these circumstances. Now, let me get to some issues that are before the court. Of course, this court, as a policy court, is concerned primarily with the interpretation of this statute and how it's to be administered. Counsel, as representatives of these parties, is ultimately concerned with who wins this lawsuit. I'm going to try to address both of those things. But let me begin with what I'm going to consider, and what I do consider, my last fallback position. And let me tell you that I do not present it, and I hope you will not perceive it as a weakness, but it ultimately is going to be the question that's going to have to be presented to discussed in the federal court. And that's the question of what this first order appointing this temporary administrator is. Is it a valid order, is it a voidable order, or is it a void ab initio order? Now that's important, in fact it's critical in this case, because of the way the statutes in the probate code are worded. First, section 131A, the statute exactly, precisely in controversy here. In its very first, in section I, makes this statement. It says, during the pendency of a contest of the appointment of a temporary administrator, the temporary appointee shall continue to act as administrator of the estate to the extent of powers conferred by the appointment. Now what that's saying is, between time of appointment and time of contest, that temporary administrator functions, continues to act as temporary administrator. That necessarily means the acts of that temporary administrator are valid. Then section 28 of the probate code says, pending appeals from orders or judgments appointing administrators, temporary administrators, etc., the appointee shall continue to act as such and shall continue the prosecution of any suits impending in favor of the estate. So, in these interim time frames, the temporary administrator is empowered to act, and whatever he does necessarily must be valid, assuming it's legal otherwise. If the court decides that this order appointing the temporary administrator is valid, of course, no problems. If you decide it's voidable, no problems, because that's when it kicks in, that language. Only if you decide that the order is void, ab initio, is there a problem. And while I don't want to be conceding anything over to the federal court, I think the handwriting's on the wall at that point. If you should decide that the order appointing temporary administrator is void ab initio, then the service on that temporary administrator is certainly in question. The Podgorski case by Justice Barrow out of the San Antonio court talks about this, and there are others. Temporary administrator...
By the time of the hearing...
Yes, sir.
to set aside where this evidence was offered, right. Or maybe wasn't offered.
Yeah, my position
by that time, you'd already made service.
Yes, sir. Yes, the temporary administrator was appointed December 23rd, served with process January 11th of 88, appointed December 23rd, 87, January 11th, 88. Contest was heard and overruled January 13th. So it was in that short time frame there that he was served. And that's the critical time frame in this lawsuit, as I view the law and as I read the lawsuit. Now, how can that order appointing the temporary administrator be void? Well, Texas law is very, very clear on that. It's void if the trial court does not have either subject matter jurisdiction or personal jurisdiction of the controversy and the persons before it. And as I read the law, those are the ways that you have a void judgment. And basically, and certainly within the context of this case, the only ways that you have a void judgment. Now, what do we have? We have an order that is regular on its face. That order is in the record before you. And it has all of the recitations that a judgment of this nature should have. Court, having heard the evidence, finds that it has jurisdiction and venue over the estate, makes recitations of jurisdiction and venue. Court further finds that the estate of Eric Hillard Nelson will be seriously damaged or dissipated unless immediate action is taken, appoints the executor, temporary administrator, and it specifies the powers of temporary administrators: receive notice of process, investigate, make demands on insurance companies which may be liable, investigate and determine the presence of liability insurance, protect and tender to forward process and tender defense to the companies. So it's an order that's regular on its face. Question is it void? Is it void? And if it is void, of course, is it void ab initio? The subject matter jurisdiction of this court cannot be questioned. The county court of Bowie County is the probate court of that county by constitution. When you file a piece of paper in that court saying we need relief under Section 131A, you have invoked the subject matter jurisdiction of that court. It's activated. I've cited other cases that talk about that and talk about void judgments, but it's activated when you file a piece of paper asking it to take action within its constitutional or statutory jurisdiction. There simply can be no question of that. Then the question becomes personal jurisdiction. That's not raised here. No one questions personal jurisdiction, but you invoke personal jurisdiction by notification, service of process, and so forth, in the manner required by law and by the Constitution. Again, we did that. It's in the record before you. No one questions. So I suggest to you that we could not have a decision, have a judgment here that's void ab initio.
If you had asked it for a divorce, that would be void ab initio?
If I had asked the probate court for one, yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Well, what is the difference between asking it for relief that it cannot give and not asking it for relief that it can give?
We did not ask it for relief it cannot give. We asked it to function under Section 131A, which is a function it has under the probate code.
So I understand it. Your argument is that if you ask for relief that is within the jurisdiction of the court to give and you do not meet the prerequisites for the giving of that relief, that doesn't mean that the jurisdiction, there was no jurisdiction. That just means that the court erred in granting relief.
Yes, that's exactly what it means. It means you didn't prove your case. Otherwise, if you have any other rule, then you've got a huge percentage of judgments subject to collateral attack. And, of course, that's ultimately where void and voidable become the most important. Now, counsel tries to get around this by talking about fundamental error. He didn't raise these issues in trial court correctly, and we can talk about that if the court wants to, but he talks about fundamental error, and it comes back to the same thing. Fundamental error is where there's no jurisdiction, which is void judgment, or where the public policy of the state requires that the court address and in some manner correct the wrong, even if it's not been properly preserved. Neither one of those is present here.
But as I understand the difference of what the two of you are saying, he says that when you file your petition asking for relief in the probate court, there are certain things you have to allege, and if you don't allege those three things that he mentioned, then the probate court never obtains jurisdiction to do anything.
Yes, sir. That is his argument, and I've got a twofold answer to that.
First, saying that's not accurate.
That's not accurate in the law. I don't read the cases to make that stringent a requirement. I think, as I read the cases, if you ask the court to do something it has the power to do, the fact that your pleadings may be defective does not deprive the court of jurisdiction. It simply means you're going to get booted out for whatever reason. But number two, and even more important, so that we don't get into that hassle, we did allege what the statute requires, as I view it. Now, we get into this unaware being good enough. There's not much point in getting into that any further than the court's already gotten into it. I don't know how you say it any more than that. If you make an unequivocal statement, this man had no will, then you have the burden of doing just what Justice Spears suggested, which is checking every place in the world where a will might exist. Simply saying unaware, I think, is certainly a common sense way to solve that problem. So, but that's my last fallback position. Under any reading of the law that I can make, that first order appointing cannot be void ab initio. If the court decides because of other defects it's voidable, then it's voidable, but I don't see how it can be void. I hope the court will address this issue because it very well may be a critical issue when we get back over to the federal court system with all of this, when this case is over. Now, let me talk for just a minute about the policy questions that this court is going to be most concerned about. When you look at the statute, Section 131A, you note a couple of very interesting things about it. Section A of the statute, the very first section, sets out the requirements for the appointment of a temporary administrator. And it simply says this: if a county judge determines that the interest of a decedent's estate, requires the immediate appointment of a personal representative, he shall, by written order, appoint one, limited power, so forth. Now, the omissions are important. First of all, it doesn't say if a county judge determines the interest of an intestate's estate. It says a decedent's estate. And to buy their argument on testacy versus intestacy, you've got to read into it the interest of an intestate's estate. Second thing is that as broad and as all-encompassing as that language is, I think it could be read to mean that a county judge, even on his own notice or her own notice, could appoint a temporary administrator without a request from anyone if he has personal knowledge sufficient to alarm him that a decedent's estate needs some kind of attention. But in any event, I don't think you can read the statute on its face as absolutely requiring, under all circumstances, that the person be intestate. And I'll talk more about that in just a moment. But from its language, I don't think it's there. Now, you go to Section B, and I consider the informational section of this statute. It says what you're supposed to say when you file an application, and it refers you over to Section 82 for some of the information. It sets out some of it in 131, and then it refers you over to 82. And 82 starts out by saying application for letters of administration, when no will, written or oral, is alleged to exist, shall state it. Listen, and item B is the name and intestacy of the decedent. So the question you're going to have to decide is whether that means that in all cases and under all circumstances, Section 131A is applicable only if the person is intestate. Once you decide that, then you're going to have to decide what is intestate. Is it intestate in Texas? Is it intestate in California? Is it intestate in South Africa or Iran? Or is it intestate in those places? What is intestate? But we'll get back to that in a minute. Think about this. Let us suppose that a person dies, and let us suppose that person has a will. Common knowledge in the community, and every member of the family knows it, but let's also suppose, for whatever reason, that will cannot be probated today. It's either locked in the lawyer's office and he's gone fishing, or it's been lost and they're going to have to use a copy and it's going to take a while to dig through the files, or it's in the safe deposit box and it's Friday afternoon and you can't get in there until after the Monday holiday on Tuesday. And let's suppose that estate requires immediate attention. You've got futures contracts that need to be moved, or you have a real estate option that needs to be exercised, or you have a boatload of bananas that's got to be sold, or whatever, and you know, the possibilities are endless. Under the petitioner's interpretation of Section 131A, you can't do anything. You can't help that estate, because we all know that the person had a will. You can't swear. You can't even say you're unaware of any will. You can't swear that he's intestate. So you can't do anything. You simply sit there and the loss occurs because you can't probate the will, you can't get any emergency relief. There you are. I suggest that's not what 131A means. I suggest that it is set up to aid in the administration of any estate, whether it's a testate estate or an intestate estate, when assistance is needed on an emergency basis.
But isn't there a difference between trying to help him unload his boatload of bananas and appointing somebody so he can sue?
Well, it wasn't us, Your Honor, because we were running up on a fairly serious deadline. Certainly, that's part of the policy question, you'll have to decide if you get to get into that, what circumstances are involved. But it strikes me that protecting the Nelson estate by being sure that any insurance policies are activated by getting proper service on the estate of this lawsuit could be an emergency situation.
Does the record reflect why approximately a year passed between when the suit was filed and when the application for administration was filed?
Probably not not enough. No, not enough, Your Honor. There, a lot was going on, and that's about the best answer I can give you at this point. We weren't just sitting around looking at the ceiling on this. And when it became apparent to us that it was not going to be a probate, an ancillary administration in Texas, then we decided we'd better take some action.
Do you agree that the an executor appointed for the estate, a resident of California, would be amenable to service in the action in the Federal District Court of Texas?
As far as I know, Your Honor, and I'm sorry that I'm not very well prepared on that question either, but I would think so. I can't see any reason why he wouldn't. Now,
all this, yes. Let me ask a question. I want to make sure I get to it. I understand why you all are very concerned with this initial petition, but we've got the whole case kind of in front of us. It was still your burden at the hearing. Well, now, when the petition was filed, and then there was a hearing, but it was an ex parte hearing.
Yes, sir.
And it was still your burden at that hearing to prove a lack of intestacy, was it not?
That's one of the questions.
A lack of intestacy in California, in any other jurisdiction.
I'm not sure that I can concede. We had a burden at that hearing. Yes, certainly we had a burden at that hearing. Now, whether
and
we
how
had,
is that satisfied? I mean, well, because according to the Court of Appeals, nothing was admitted there.
Well, I think they probably were talking about the second hearing at that point. They were talking about the contest. See, on the first hearing, the only thing we have from that is the order itself, the one that I was looking at a few minutes ago, which recites that the court heard evidence, made, and the court finds it has jurisdiction, then you find that the estate requires assistance immediately or it's going to be dissipated and so forth. We have no statement of facts from that hearing, none. But we have a recitation and a judgment regular on its face that the court heard evidence. Now, under every procedural rule that I know anything about, the court is bound to accept that absent a statement of facts, even in direct attack. Absent a statement of facts showing to the contrary. So the answer is yes, we have a burden at that hearing, and this court made the findings necessary to show that we satisfied that burden. And of course, that's the order that I think ultimately is the key in terms of order in this case. Now, the second part of that, and part of your question that bothered me a little bit, is your statement that we had to prove that he was intestate, and I come back to my basic position, which is that intestacy is not a requirement for the use of Section 131A. Any action taken under 131A can be halted immediately by proof of a probate starting in Texas, an ancillary administration or a full probate, or perhaps in some other official recognition of that estate. But
only in Texas?
I'm sorry.
It can't be halted by proof of
right. My position is that it cannot, because this gets into the question of what is intestacy, and this is another one you're going to have to address if we get over into this. What do we mean when we say somebody's testate or intestate? I wrote on a piece of paper a few minutes ago when I was listening to the argument. I just wrote at the top, will, and I wrote on it, I leave everything to my wife and sign my name. Am I testate from that document? Well, I suggest to you that I'm not. I suggest to you that's just a piece of paper, and it has no legal effect until a Texas court says that is a will and we're admitting it to probate. And I think that's the problem that the petitioner faces here. Number one, they didn't put any of that stuff into evidence that they had. It never tended the record before you. You can read it. And try as they might, they can't argue it into evidence. They didn't offer it, and the court didn't say anything about it to indicate that it accepted it. But number two, that will in California is not officially a will in the state of Texas. It's not recognized under the laws of Texas until it's admitted to probate or in some other manner given official recognition in Texas. You can have an ancillary probate. You might even have it as mention of title. But it has none of that's been done. And until that happens, the Nelson estate is an intestate estate under the laws of the state of Texas. You can't have it any other way or you're going to get the probate code so messed up that you can't ever administer an estate. Your testate, if you have a will that's recognized by the laws of this state in some official manner in the procedures provided in the laws of the state. Your intestate, if you don't.
and that's the only way it can be. It's like another human condition that that we know about. You can't be a little bit testate. You either are or you are not. And in the state of Texas, Ricky Nelson is intestate because he has never done anything to give that will official recognition. He has not got a full probate, an ancillary probate. He hasn't filed his name on title.
Was it sealed at that time?
Yes, sir. It was sealed.
So even if he knew there was one, he didn't know what was in it.
That's exactly right. We never saw it until it showed up at the hearing. That's the first time that we saw the will was when they, well, they attached it to their content. But back to your original question, unless I'm missing something, I don't think simply advising the executor, if we could find out who it was, that we have a claim against the estate would affect service of process in the suit pending in federal court. Now, once we get that information, then perhaps we could have made service. But when all of this occurred, we still didn't have any of that information. We didn't know who they were or what was going on. Now, there's a long argument in the petitioner's brief about how they proved that he was, how they got all of that stuff into evidence. You can simply read it, you can read the record, and decide whether it was in evidence in the trial court. I suggest to you, as I've just been saying, that it doesn't make any difference whether it was in evidence or not, because it's still putting it in evidence in the hearing in this case. Doesn't give it official recognition as a testamentary document under the probate code. It may or may not have any effect on the contest, but it certainly doesn't make him testate in Texas. Now, the ultimate question, but the final question you've got to address is what kind of procedure is to be followed under the statute when you get to the contest question. And there are two ways you can go. You can say that as the Court of Appeals did, that you treat it like a temporary injunction and you simply go in and start over and you have all new evidence. And the proponent of the temporary administration must completely prove his case again, and then the contestant can come in and disprove it. Or you can treat it as you do other proceedings where an entity is established and anyone contesting it must come in and prove that it should be vacated for some reason. We can live with either procedure, but I suggest to you that, and certainly the easiest way to resolve this case, the best procedure is once the temporary administration has been established and specific purposes set out, if there's a contest, then let the contestant come in at the contest hearing and show reasons why that should be vacated. It's not like your temporary restraining order that has a fixed duration that is going to expire at its own terms within 10 days or whatever the life term of that may be. This is something that has been established, and if there's a valid reason to set it aside, then the contestant should say that and should prove it. But as I say, I think we can live with the other, and there's certainly some merit in the procedure that was suggested by the Court of Appeals. What it comes down to in the final analysis is that we did everything, as I read the statute and as a common sense reading of the statute requires, we did everything that was required to do to establish this temporary administration, and we did it for a valid reason. I hope the court will affirm the lower courts. If it chooses not to, I hope it will address the issue of the void or voidable nature of the judgment. And if all else fails, I hope you'll remand in the interest of justice. Thank you.
Your Honor, counsel talked about being a little bit testate. A man intestate in California, but he crosses the border into this state and he suddenly ceases to be intestate. I'm not arguing, Your Honors, that Ricky Nelson is a little bit testate. He is completely testate because testacy only has to do with when, it only has meaning in relation to property, because counsel talked about the interest of the estate. The whole purpose of probate proceedings are to protect estate assets, to marshal them, and to preserve them for the beneficiaries and the creditors. The argument totally overlooks that probate is an in rem proceeding. Jurisdiction is determined not only by jurisdiction over people. There has to be property here. There has to be property within the confines of Texas. A California executor has no authority over Texas property. The cases are replete that an executor only exercises property within the scope of the geographic confines of the state in which he's appointed. The only asset even alleged to be believed to be present in Texas
is an insurance policy. That insurance policy is a chosen action. That chosen action is deemed to be located where the decedent was domiciled at the time of his death, and Ms. Neal has admitted that that domicile was not this state. The trial court has absolutely no jurisdiction over any item of property, and in the absence of an item of property, didn't the legislature understand what it was doing when the statutory requirements and the statutory jurisdictional requirements required that there be an asset in the state of Texas?
Assuming that the order granted appointing the temporary administrator was invalid, why isn't the appointment voidable rather than void?
Well, Your Honor, the distinction between voidable and void is a very interesting one. I think counsel is confusing voidable and void for an invocation of the probate court's potential jurisdiction. Undoubtedly, this falls within the potential jurisdiction of the probate court, but for the fact that they pleaded themselves out of court by alleging that the only property that they believed to be located in the state, they went ahead and alleged facts that showed it can't be located in this state as a matter of law.
But that only shows that they weren't, assuming that's true, that only shows they weren't entitled to a temporary administration in Texas. Why doesn't that permit the administrator to act until the order is reversed and service in effect to be preserved in the federal court?
Because the problem with that is that the only purpose for which an administration can be appointed is to preserve and marshal estate assets. If there are no estate assets, there can be no valid administration.
But is that a fundamental error that affects the jurisdiction of the court?
Yes, sir.
Sounds like it to me.
Yes, sir.
That's something you can come up and say, but wait a minute, Judge. He hasn't proved this, and therefore you should dismiss it, and that would happen. But in terms of whether or not the court had subject matter jurisdiction, it did.
Oh, undoubtedly, this is a probate proceeding. And undoubtedly, the court had jurisdiction over the nature of the suit.
And the fact that it's an in rem jurisdiction even strengthens that.
The fact that it's in rem jurisdiction strengthens the fact that there has to be property either actually or constructively located within the geographic confines of the United States. And the Supreme Court of Noyer versus Neff addressed this question very directly. But
you can't say it didn't have jurisdiction until it's determined that there's no property in the state. That's something that's defensive that must be raised, is it not?
Your Honor, I believe that has to be invoked on the face of the pleading, just like jurisdiction of every district court must be invoked by the face of the pleading. If jurisdiction cannot be ascertained from the four corners of the document, and certainly if the document reflects from its own four corners that there is no jurisdiction.
Yeah, that record's not before, the pleading is not before, all correct?
Yes, sure. The application for temporary administration states that Ricky Nelson was not domiciled in Texas, and that they are aware of the assets included in the estate, except that they believe, which is permissible, Justice Spears, under the code, they believe that an insurance policy exists. Well, that insurance policy, Your Honors, is a chosen action, and that chosen action, as a matter of law, is constructively located in the state of California.
If they had said the insurance policy is in Texas, you say they would have been all right.
If they had said Mr. Nelson was a Texas domiciliary,
or that the assets of the estate is a proper insurance policy in Texas, that would have been adequate to meet that requirement.
No, Your Honor, it doesn't matter where the papers are, because the property is not the piece of the paper. The property are the legal rights that accrue by virtue of the agreement. The insurance policy is a juridical act; it's contract. And by virtue and the value, the asset, the value to the estate are the rights accrued under that contract. And regardless of where those papers may be located, those contract rights are always going to follow me during my life and you during yours as to where we are domiciled. And when we die, that's where they are deemed to be located. So not only do we have a failure to plead and prove in test, a failure to plead and prove in testacy, We also have fundamental error because no property's in the state. And then finally, we have no pleading. The facts that are pleaded affirmatively show that there is no necessity for administration. Mr. Countess argued from the hypothetical, what do you do if there are circumstances when a Texan dies without a will, or dies with a will, but the circumstances prevent it from being probated? Your Honors, I posit the question, what circumstances could prevent it from being probated? If it's lost, the probate code provides for the probate of lost wills. If it's been destroyed accidentally, the probate code covers that. If there's not two deaths, you simply file the will as a muniment of title. If there is no will, you simply file an affidavit of heirship. The probate code has been very carefully thought out and has dealt with these situations. The man's bananas are not going to rot. We respectfully submit that in the absence of any allegation, that there has been no showing of necessity for administration, which requires, as a matter of law, and the cases are clear, it requires the existence of two deaths. And if one thinks about it, counsel argued that, well, there may be other situations where necessity, where a situation may arise where the property needs attention. Well, that's fine. I have no problem with that. If there are two deaths, that means there may be a squabble over the property and who's going to get what when. If there's only one debt or no debts, if there's a will, you simply file it as a muniment of title and take control of the property in standard. If there's no will, you simply file your affidavit of heirship and sell the bananas. And therefore, we respectfully submit that because there has been no pleading and no proof of those three elements, to hold the appointment of a temporary administrator in this case valid would constitute a violation of the due process clause and the due course of law clause of both the state and federal constitutions. Because what it in effect allows is that one who had never had any contact with the state of Texas, never elected to own any property here, never elected to do any business here, if someone, even as in this case, a person who is not a citizen of this state, commits no torts here, they can be sued here simply by a person coming in and alleging, oh, it'd be convenient, I kind of like these courts, they look nice, and we'd really like to sue here, and so, and by the way, I don't know if there's a will or not, I haven't bothered to check. And therefore, why don't you appoint a temporary administrator, and I can serve him, regardless of whether or not the decedent had any contact with this state or not. The final question, thank you very much.
Thank you. That concludes the business of the court for this session. The foregoing causes are submitted on brief and oral arguments. Marshall.
Judge, Pete Rudd. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas is now being adjourned, subject to call.